This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 16 and 17.
Peter had just received a heavy revelation, a heavy revy. Here's a guy that gets heavy revies, but it's gone to his head. He's the oracle of God now. I mean, he knows so much that he's going to straighten out Jesus. And so he pulls Jesus aside and he says, "Oh no, that's not going to happen to you. No way, Jesus." Peter must have thought he was the Pope. Instead, he was just a dope. But he, Jesus, turned and said to Peter, "Oh boy, talk about burst your bubble. Talk about a punch in the gut. Talk about a pop in the ego." Jesus said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Oh my. Peter goes from revelation to devastation in a matter of minutes. You know, it's funny, just because God uses you profoundly and speaks to you directly, it doesn't mean that you can't, in the next sentence, slip up and find yourself being manipulated by Satan himself. You can go from an instrument of God to a tool of Satan in just four verses. You know, when we're saved, God forgives us. And He puts His Spirit within us. But He does nothing to alter our humanness. That comes when we're raptured. We still think human thoughts, don't we? We're still influenced by human and often sinful perspectives. And it's not always easy to differentiate between God's thoughts and my thoughts, or even worse, Satan's thoughts. And I hate to tell you, but there's no magical formula for knowing when it's God speaking or when it's some other voice. You get that discernment through time and through growth and through exposure to the mind and will and Word of God. It takes the humbling of your heart with repentance. It takes the saturating of your mind with the Word. It takes allowing the Spirit to challenge and change every assumption about life. It's a process. This is why rocks need to remember they're nothing but solidified dirt. And notice one more point from our passage. Jesus identifies Peter's desire to prevent the cross as an idea inspired by Satan himself. Hey, this had been Satan's strategy from the Garden of Eden. Satan wanted to keep Jesus off of the cross. This is why he tried to kill Jesus with the sword of Herod while a baby in Bethlehem. This is why he tried to drown Jesus in the storm on the sea. This is why they tried to throw Jesus off the cliff there in Nazareth. This is why Satan used Judas to betray Jesus. You understand, no one needed Judas to identify Jesus. Satan used Judas because it was a dagger in Jesus' back. To be betrayed by one of his most trusted men. What would this do in Jesus' heart? It might tempt him to abandon the cross and the salvation it would bring. You see, unlike Peter, Jesus knew that he was destined for the cross, not the crown. And any thought otherwise, to bypass the cross, was a thought from Satan. Well, verse 24, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.'" You know, there are scores of people today who would have agreed with Peter's confession. They believe that Jesus is the Messiah. The problem is they're not ready to follow him to the cross. They agree with his identity, but they haven't yet embraced his destiny. They want the Christ, but they're not so sure about the cross. And Jesus teaches his disciples that you can't have one without the other. To believe in Jesus is to take up your cross. Now, the cross was a symbol of complete subjugation to the will of Rome. The Romans invented crucifixion, the horror of crucifixion, not because it was the most efficient means of execution. Oh no, there were cleaner, there were quicker, there were probably more inexpensive ways to crucify a person, to kill a victim, than to crucify them. The cross, though, served a purpose. It was deliberately bloody and vicious and cruel and torturous. You see, the Romans used crucifixion to make a statement to the masses. The crucifixion was a statement. This is why crucifixions were always carried out by roadsides, or they were carried out on a mountaintop near a road, places where the victims would be seen publicly. The cross was a reminder. It was a reminder that despite whatever freedoms the Romans might have extended to their subjects for a time, at any moment those privileges could be pulled out from under them. That Roman authority was supreme and complete. That's what the cross was all about. In reality, no one had any more rights under Rome than that man hanging on the cross. Now Jesus says to follow Him, it requires three steps. First, deny yourself. Stop being selfish. Stop just thinking about yourself. It's just not about you anymore. You got to deny yourself. Second, take up your cross. What does that mean? That means to submit to a new authority. To surrender my life to Jesus as if I were hanging on a cross. To give up all of my rights and privileges and say, Jesus, I belong to you. Just like the crucified person said, we belong to Rome. It's to take up your cross is to say, I belong to you, Jesus. I surrender my life to you. And then third, to follow in Jesus' footsteps. To follow Jesus. To think and say and do like Jesus would think and say and do. Jesus says, if you want to follow me, you got to deny yourself. And you got to take up your cross. And you got to follow me. Reminds me of Tom Mauser. His 15-year-old son, Daniel, was shot in the Columbine High School massacre. In months after losing Daniel, Tom began to speak out against gun violence. He's now been touring the country, sharing his story and his talk. And it's interesting, every time Tom speaks, he wears a pair of Reebok tennis shoes. Every time he goes to a speaking engagement, he wears a specific pair of Reebok tennis shoes. They were Daniel's shoes. They were his son's shoes. Tom is literally following in his son's footsteps. Jesus says, if you want to follow me, deny yourself, submit yourself to me, and then lace on my sandals and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Now, I want you to understand this. Life is like a slab of meat. There it is right there. That's your life, okay? That's your life. Life is like a slab of meat. It is a perishable commodity. Now, you can hold on to your T-bone steak if you want. You can hold on to it. You can put it in your pocket. Ladies, you can take that slab of meat and you can put it in your purse. Guys, you can put it in your briefcase tomorrow and you can carry it around with you all day long. But here's the problem. If you try to hold on to it, it's going to spoil. The only way you can keep that piece of meat is to eat it. To let your body assimilate it. The only way you can keep it is if you eat it and let it live in you. And you live in it. You keep it by giving it away, by eating it. Life is also a perishable commodity. Your life is like that piece of meat. You try to hold on to it. You view your life as your exclusive possession, something that you're to use as you please, and it will wither in your hands. It will rot. It will spoil. The only way to keep your life is to give it away. To let your life be assimilated into the will and life of Jesus Christ. Only then will you live forever if you live in Him. Verse 27 says, for the Son of Man will come in the glory of His Father with His angels, and then He will reward each according to His works. Assuredly I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. This is an astounding statement. That there were people right there listening to Jesus who would see the Son of Man coming in His glory. Now that's an event still future, isn't it? Some people think that Jesus was saying that there would be people there that would live to the rapture. But But we actually see what Jesus meant by this statement in chapter 17. Because there were three men in the crowd that day who would see the Son of Man in all of His glory at the transfiguration in the next chapter. Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, His brother, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and He was transfigured before them. Remember, Caesarea Philippi was at the base of Mount Hermon. Jesus takes His disciples to the mountaintop. It was probably a 6-day climb to ascend the 9,200 feet up the mountain. Once on one of our trips to Israel, I talked our guide into driving to the top of Mount Hermon. I'll never forget it. Apart from a military installation up there, there was a military base up there. There was nothing up there. It was just kind of this eerie calm on the top of Mount Hermon. There was no monastery. There were no archaeological digs. There was no shrines. It was only a barren peak. But there was this surreal, kind of mystical feeling. I'll never forget it. It was as if we were standing on holy ground. Well, on that day, Jesus and His three disciples, when they ascended to the peak of Mount Hermon, they were standing on holy ground. For these disciples were treated to an amazing and astonishing sight. Jesus was transfigured before His disciples. Our word metamorphosis is derived from the Greek word translated transfigured. And it describes a change that occurs from the inside out. When a caterpillar becomes a butterfly, it's a metamorphosis. Suddenly, the veil of Jesus' humanity is peeled back, and His supernatural glory is allowed to radiate and shine and pulsate through His mortal body. The brilliance of His Godhood now burns through His manhood. Notice what we're told. His face shone like the sun, and His clothes became as white as the light. You remember when Moses went up on top of the mountain and he saw God's glory? We're told that his face glowed. He kind of had the divine shine. But the shine eventually wore off, for it was a reflected glory. Here, Jesus is not reflecting glory. Jesus is radiating glory. It's coming from within Him, not from without. It's not something He's just picking up from outside. He is God. He possesses this glory. It's burning from within His nature. You know, during His first visit to earth, Jesus' glory was not always apparent to the people around Him. I mean, as a newborn baby covered in fluids and blood, it was hard to see that He was God. As a sweat-drenched carpenter with sawdust in his hair and splinters in his hands. Even as a backwoods preacher from Nazareth, he didn't look real glorious. There was nothing about Jesus' appearance or exterior that had tipped them off to His divinity. Until we come to Matthew 17. For a moment, the glory that Jesus possessed and will possess for all eternity was placed on display for these three disciples to see. His humanity gets peeled away. And His glory shines brightly. Verse 3, and behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with Him. Now, this was not a reincarnation. This was a reappearance of Moses and Elijah. Moses represented the law. Elijah represented the prophets. Remember, Moses was the founder of Judaism. Elijah was the protector of Judaism from the idolatry of the evil Ahab and Jezebel. Moses and Elijah appeared to show that the glory of Jesus was greater than even the law or the prophets, that the preeminence belonged to Jesus. And it's interesting. Luke chapter 9, verse 31 tells us what Jesus and Moses and Elijah were talking about. Any guesses? They spoke of His decease, which He was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. It was a crucifixion chat room. I mean, they were talking about the ultimate sacrifice, about His crucifixion. And I'm sure that Jesus was hoping that His disciples would have eavesdropped, that they would have caught on. But instead, Peter's next comments indicate that the conversation just flew right over his head. For then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If You wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for You and one for Moses and one for Elijah. The Feast of Tabernacles was coming up on the calendar. And during the feast, Jewish families would live outside in their backyards in these little thatched tents. And they would sleep out under the stars. And it could be that Peter wanted to celebrate the feast there on the mountaintop. Verse 5. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him." It's as if God is saying to Peter, "Do you know who you're dealing with here? Do you know who this man is?" And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and they were greatly afraid. God in heaven interrupts Peter's wild ramblings. There is a time to talk and there is a time to hush and listen. And this was a time to listen, not talk. You know, it had been 600 years since the time of the prophet Ezekiel that the Shekinah glory had shone in Israel. Now suddenly, this glory cloud returns and the Father speaks. Peter needs to listen. And notice the Father's instructions concerning Jesus. Hear him. Peter didn't want to hear about Jesus' suffering and sacrifice and crucifixion. That was the problem. He preferred to savor the mountaintop experience, to bask in the glory. Peter, James, and John didn't understand that they were given this experience not as an end in itself, but as a preparation for the road that lay ahead. Hey, when God gives us glimpses of glory, it's sometimes to prepare us for suffering and sacrifice. Hebrews 12 says of Jesus, "For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross." You know, it's easier to endure the sacrifice once you've been enlightened by the glory. Verse 7, "But Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and do not be afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. At the Father's voice, they fell on their face. At the voice of Jesus, he lifted them to their feet." We need both voices, don't we? The voice of greatness and the voice of grace. "Now as they came down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is risen from the dead." This was a vision that none of the three disciples who had experienced it would ever, ever forget. In 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter recalls this experience and he gives testimony to it. Even at the end of his life, this experience was still vivid to Peter. Verse 10, "And his disciples asked him, saying, Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must first come?" Now Malachi 4 verse 5 had predicted that Elijah would appear before Jesus' second coming. And the Jews expected Elijah before their Messiah. But Jesus answered and said to them, "Indeed, Elijah is coming first and will restore all things." In other words, Jesus doesn't deny Malachi's prophecy. But he goes on, "But I say to you that Elijah has already come. And they did not know him, but did to him whatever they wished. Likewise, the Son of Man is also about to suffer at their hands." And then the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist. Now, John was not literally Elijah, but John, we're told, came in the spirit and power of Elijah. Here's a way to think about it. John was not the Elijah. John was just a Elijah. You see, here was the problem. The Jews didn't grasp the dual comings of Christ. You know, they just saw one coming. They didn't understand he'd come a first time as a man, as a suffering servant. He would come the second time as the King of glory. They didn't have that nuance. They didn't understand that. They just assumed that he was coming, and when he came, Elijah would precede him. Well, Jesus understood that's how they thought. And so Jesus says, Elijah has come. But not the Elijah, a Elijah. John came in the spirit and power of Elijah. John was the Elijah that had already come. But the Jews had rejected him as they will Jesus. The real Elijah will come before his second coming. Verse 14. "And when they had come to the multitude, a man came to him, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and suffers severely, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water." The Greek word translated epileptic is unfortunate. The old King James is more accurate, though less politically correct. It reads lunatic. You know, my son's a lunatic. The word literally means moonstruck. In Eastern culture, there was a superstition that if you slept outside on a bright night and the moonlight actually shined on your face, it could drive you nuts and turn you crazy. Thus the phrase lunar tick literally means struck by the moon. Of course, the boy in question was not moonstruck, he was demon struck. The desperate father says in verse 16, "So I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Sadly, the disciples were powerless over the demon. But then Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me." Author Kent Hughes, he writes this, "These are fitting words for the church today, which is so well equipped, rich, and instructed, and yet so often powerless. We cannot and dare not duck the Master's diagnosis. Are we a faithless and perverse generation?" Jesus has power over Satan. Do we have faith? And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast him out?" And so Jesus said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For assuredly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Guys, simple faith can alter landscapes, both topographical and social landscapes as well. Through faith, we can mow down mountains. Nothing is impossible for people with faith. Notice the contrast in our passage. Faith as a little bitty grain of mustard seed. Problems like huge mountains. You see, so often we make the mistake of thinking that our faith has to be equal to our foe. Not so. It's not our faith that moves mountains, it's the hand of God. You don't need faith enough to move mountains. You just need faith enough to move the hand of God, and the hand of God will move the mountain. And God is so willing to work on our behalf. He loves us so much. He's so eager to do the miraculous in our lives that faith to move the hand of God is not much. It's not a big faith at all. It's just the faith the size of a little mustard seed. That'll move the hand of God, and the hand of God will move the mountains in your life. Then Jesus adds in verse 21, "However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." You see, the disciples had cast out demons before, but apparently not all demons are equally determined. And when faced with a stubborn demon, we need an extra dose of spiritual strength. Prayer and fasting fortifies our faith. Fasting detaches me from the flesh. Prayer attaches me to God. That's a good combination. And Jesus is saying that you can't take on a determined demon unless you've been working out spiritually through prayer and fasting. That's what prepares you for the real heavyweights. Now, while they were staying in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And the third day he will be raised up." And they were exceedingly sorrowful. Again, what's he teaching them? He's focusing on where he's going. They understand his identity, but now he wants them to try to understand and grasp and be prepared for his destiny. And if they're going to follow him, they have to share that same destiny. They have to be willing to take up their cross as well. Tonight we end where we started. We know who Jesus is, but are we headed where Jesus is going? Will we deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow Jesus?
Our greatest calling in life is to be more like Jesus, and the Gospels are the single best place to learn more about how our Savior lived on this earth. Studying the Gospels gives us examples of how to live by the power of God's Spirit. Each day, Pastor Sandy will be teaching through the Gospel of Matthew, with hopes that we'll grow to be more like Jesus. This has been another edition of Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. He's the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, we're sure that today's message in Matthew has blessed and encouraged you in your walk with Jesus Christ. Maybe you'd like to review this message again, or perhaps a family member or friend has come to mind today. Log on to sandyadams.org and click on the radio program option in the main menu. There you'll find today's message. All you need to do is remember today's date and log on to sandyadams.org. Or you can give us a call here at the church. Our phone number is 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. Someone is standing by to talk with you. Again, just mention today's date and we'll send you the full-length CD. Next time, Pastor Sandy will continue taking us verse by verse through the Gospel of Matthew. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, we want to say thank you for tuning in, and may God bless you.